So with that, I guess I will turn it over to questions from the audience. And
hi, my name is V. I was just wondering, when do you need to start talking to you guys and visiting schools? And I mean, for someone that hasn't taken the GMAT, is there some type of order that you usually recommend, or try to kind of simultaneously try to do everything?
Right. Well, was anyone here for a long-term planning event a while back? Okay. Well, this is one of the things we talked about a few months ago. If you would have asked me, I would have said, you know, get your GMAT underway. You don't want to be doing, you know, several things at once. Now the reality is you probably have to do several things at once. I mean, you can take your GMAT now, and if you're a conservative person, you can take your GMAT now, wait for your score, and then use that to help determine which schools you're going to apply to, and then start thereafter. And the first round, for those of you who don't know, business schools have three rounds of applications, and the first, you know, earlier is generally considered to be better, but it's not earlier at all costs. You shouldn't, you know, much like we were saying to Mikhail, you know, with his volume application strategy, you shouldn't force a bunch of bad applications in the first round just to get them in the first round. The third round is very challenging, but the first round typically ends around mid-October, early to mid-October. The second round will end usually the first and second week of January. And so, you know, if you need the time to study for your GMAT now, apply in the second round. If you're a confident person, if you're saying, hey, I know myself, I'm going to do well in the GMAT, I just need to study for it, it's a matter of setting a schedule, then we're happy to start with you now. You know, it really has to do a lot more with your risk profile. One of the nice things about the way we work on a package basis is that there's no harm in starting now. You know, you're not going to be penalized. You'll have the opportunity to work slowly. You can't study for the GMAT all day and all night. You know, take a break. Start working on your brainstorming. Start working on your resume and be able to hit the ground running and maybe surprise yourself and get a make significant headway that way. When you do well on the GMAT, you're ready to press send. Or if pick a conservative school, one that you feel like even if you end up on the low end of your GMAT range, you'll still feel comfortable, you know, pressing submit for that school. So there, if you're feeling like maybe a little bit anxious about the demands of the application process, there are lots of ways we could start working with you now to make it a lot more palatable for you. At the same time, we're not a pressure kind of group, and so if you do want to take the GMAT and then decide, that's also fine. Let's do the mic for the people who are listening at home.
Assuming you want to apply for the first round and you don't manage to get the GMAT until then, can you basically hand in your GMAT score a little later?
Most schools will want to see a GMAT score on your application. They won't let you apply without one. If you have another score that comes up that's immediately after the deadline or within, you know, before a decision has been made, then you can send it in, and the school will take a look at your new score. If you've done better, they'll take that into consideration. Some schools might even, reevaluate your application in light of that if there's a massive, massive jump and that was a major concern of theirs.
Okay. Hi, my question is, how many schools is too much if you're applying to all the schools in the same round?
Well, again, you know, that how many schools are too much if you're applying to all schools in the same round? I mean, it really varies from person to person. Again, quality before speed. I think instead of looking at an absolute number, you should set a loose goal. You know, I'm going to do three or four in the first round, hypothetically. And if I don't get to four, so be it. I'll do a higher application. I'll do a better application in the second round. If I don't get to three, so I'll have two high-quality applications, and I'll move to the second round. That also is part of the argument for starting earlier, because you don't want to be stuck in a situation where you're only applying the second round, the third round becomes a lot more difficult, and now you're saying to yourself, I have to get five applications in round two. So it's a good reason to start early. But there's no lucky number. Everyone has different personal demands, family demands, work demands, community demands. You know, one person might have 5 hours a week to work on it, and another one might have 20. So it just really depends.
Greg, for someone who's applying round one this year, how do you think schools will perceive someone who, I guess, doesn't have much community volunteering experience and they start like right now and only have a few months pretty much.
Right. Did you come late? I mean, we talked about that. You know, if you have an interesting story to tell, you have an interesting story to tell, and you shouldn't be ashamed or back away from it or anything like that. You know, it depends on a case by case basis. I think I was telling Chris earlier on today that we had a candidate a couple of years ago, who unfortunately a family member fell ill, and he went out and started doing some volunteer work with the hospital where his relative was being treated, and he started to do some fundraising, and then what he did really caught fire, and then he ended up, they asked him to join the board of the foundation, and so he did that, and they expanded his fundraising initiative, and all this occurred over about 2 months, and it was a great story to tell. It had a lot of strength to it. It just depends on the story, but it happened in a very short period of time. So if you've accomplished something, if you can point to something you've accomplished, fantastic. I think the mistake that people make is they assume that there's some sort of community service requirement and that they have to be able to tell a community story, and they try to force some story, and they haven't done anything that's really that significant. And community service is not a prison sentence. It's not, you know, like sometimes on Law and Order, you know, or like it's not on Law and Order, but on TV shows, they sentence people to community service, and you know, it's not, you're not being sentenced to it. It's not like, okay, I have to do this, so I'm going to go out and it'll be on my application and they'll see and I'll get in because I've done some community service. It's much more along the lines of, can I show something complementary or supplementary to my work life via this activity? Can I show that I'm an interesting person who's achieving in many different spheres? And that's really what they're looking for. And if you can do that, fantastic.
Hi. Is this on? Yeah. I have two questions. First, how do you go about an application or a profile that seems slightly unfocused? So you have a major that's not related to your career, that's probably not very related to your application to business school. So that would be my first question.
I don't understand. So what's
my major was bio. I work in marketing, and I'm going into business school.
Okay, so your major is not related to your career, and your career is not related to your goals? Is that what you're saying?
Well,
sorry.
Yeah, I guess in some sense, sure. And then secondly, do you mention an application for a dual degree program, or do you not mention the fact that you're applying to another school, like another...
For a dual degree program within the same institution.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Look, you know, the school is not... I think there's this, again, a bit of a misconception out there that the school is expecting you to have been laser-focused from birth. You know, I was wearing a suit to elementary school, and then, you know, I was in junior achievement, and then I went and took a management degree, undergrad, and then I went to work for, you know, for a consulting firm, and now I'm going to business school, and I'm going to go back into consulting. My entire life says consultant. It doesn't work that way. They recognize that people have interesting lives, and people make choices, and they just want to understand your path. If you changed careers every 6 months, you know, for 2 years, 3 years, you probably have a problem on your hands. But if you took undergraduate degree X and you've been in, you know, one professional job for a couple of years, fantastic. And you want to switch careers now, that's fine. This is not an atypical story. And again, you know, you don't have anything to run from. And schools, someone was saying yesterday, I don't remember which school was saying, the only thing they something along the lines of the unexplained questions kill applicants. And so, you know, you don't want to run from anything and try to hide or make yourself into something you're not. Just explain why you made these choices, and it might be really interesting. It may, you know, the story of you know, how the English literature major became you know, the investment banker or whatever that was, or the marketer. You know, that, why not? You know, there's no reason why it shouldn't happen. And how did that happen? And why? And that could be very different and interesting.
When I was applying to business school, I was a physics major undergrad. I taught high school physics. I went to Ireland and studied a really useful language, Irish Gaelic. And then I talked about, oh, I'm going to go back, I'm going to be a consultant, and then I'm going to get into the entertainment industry. It was a little chaotic, but I did manage to get into business school and wound up doing education while I was there, doing a lot of TAing and setting up programs to help other people, and also filming all my classmates and putting on an hour-long video show every 6 weeks that was like Saturday Night Live. And so it was a little weird, but you know, this place accepted me. It was Duke, and I love that place for that reason. So you can get in with a sort of curvy story. You do have to figure out the trends, the connections between them all. but they're not looking for cookie cutter, and that I certainly did not fit that first mold that you said before I wound up going to, you know, major consulting firm. So,
right. Yeah, great anecdotal, and all the way from the University of Smallopia, you know.
Exactly. And now I do my acting in front of you.
Yeah. I realized I forgot. Aaron reminded me that you had a second question about joint degrees, and. Yeah, I mean, most schools ask you to disclose that you're looking at a joint degree. Some joint degrees can be tremendous entrees into schools. You know, if there's a niche program, I was at NYU the other day. They've got an MBA / master's degree in French. You know, if you're interested, I suppose, in doing business in France, I guess that's why you would do that. But you know, if you're applying. Don't all of a sudden all you guys go running to apply to that program. But you know, if you're going to apply to that program, I would assume they have trouble filling it on a year in, year out basis. It could be a great entree for you into that program. You know, master's degrees, and there are a lot of joint degrees out there, and there are a lot of schools that will allow you to create your own joint degree. And so, you know, I think it's if anything, it's advantageous. And I wouldn't hide from that either.
Hi, I have a question regarding the application process for job experience. I'll kind of ask the question relating to myself. How much leeway does a person have, for instance, having 3 years of experience for a major corporate company, one of the top in the world, as opposed to someone who has 5 to 6 years of experience in small company A? I mean, what I'm kind of asking is how much leeway does that corporate name that you work for have on your application process?
Well, it's never the amount of time that you've spent at your company. It's much more the quality of your experience. You can't really compare two people's experience. You just have to look at your own experience and talk about the merits of your experience. And there's room at business school for the person who spent 6 years at a major multinational and the person who spent 3 years at the local, I don't know, retail franchise or something like that. Anyway, it doesn't matter. There's room for everyone. You know, depending on, there's room for all these candidates as long as you can illustrate what's interesting and distinct about your experience and how you'll add to the class. So apples and oranges.
Sorry, I have another question. So are you saying it really is not relevant if you work for a huge corporation as opposed to one that's not? Because in my eyes, I think just working for corporate America is a lot different than working for a small end company. And do business schools kind of view that differently, or they kind of see that same across the board, just depending on the story that one has to tell?
I guess what I'm saying is, you know, the experience might not be the same, but there's an appreciation for both, and the schools want to have diversity in their classrooms. They probably want to have both represented. I think the schools would look and they'd say, well, if we don't have anyone here from a Fortune 100 company, we probably have a deficiency in our class right now. And I think they'd probably start looking through their applications and trying to find someone. I'm sure they have ample candidates from those companies. At the same time, they want to have small business people. I don't think that there's a difference in I think there is a vast difference in those kinds of candidates, but I think there's room for both. I hope I'm answering your question. I feel like I might not be, so maybe we can talk afterwards, but there's definitely room for both.
Yeah, maybe I'll just thinking of my own experience. I never worked in corporate America before going to business school. I worked in a high school for 5 years and in a small architecture firm for 1 year. So what my particular experience was very important to my application. And what I had to talk about was how I progressed, things that I set up at this school or at that, and what the record of accomplishment was. And I was very proud of saying, yeah, I started this summer program and we made like $2,500. You know, like, and I can't even imagine what that would be at a major corporation. Would you even put that down? But, you know, that was a big accomplishment for me and for this school and so forth. So I think it's all within the realm that you're dealing with. And yes, it's very different to work at a high school than to work at an architecture firm than to work at GM or something. But you can show accomplishment anywhere.
Yeah, so. I would echo that. I was a speechwriter. Came from a very unorthodox background, and I ran a $40,000 PR campaign that I dreamed up. And for an embassy, procuring $40,000 for a PR campaign was really significant. We had to do a lot of clawing, you know, to get that money. And It was a great story. The dollar values don't matter. People who are at major multinationals, not to discount what they're doing, but are still probably working in relatively small teams, just like someone at a small firm would be. And there's just, there are merits to all of this. It's all about your story.
Yeah, hi. My question is regarding the application process. About how much time do you think you should spend on the application? If you're going to spend, a good amount of your free time, if you have, let's say, if you finish your GMAT about a month before, would that be enough time to finish your applications within that time?
It varies so much from person to person. It just depends on your creativity, your level of your ability to write, your ability to reflect on yourself. The amount of whether you're a perfectionist or whether you're someone who just accepts good enough, which I think is something to be a perfectionist on. How efficient you are. There's so many variables that it's impossible to say, hey, allow yourself. I mean, in an ideal world, you'll go home, you'll start tomorrow, whether you work with us or not. I'm not trying to push anyone to work with us, and you'll work on it you'll work on it slowly at a measured pace, keeping it, continuing to improve and reflect until you have a high quality application. And after that, if you finish early, you'll sit back and have a beer, and if not, you'll work to the deadline.
Hi, my name is Monique Johnson, and it's kind of a two-part question. I noticed on your slide of your case studies, if a person had a weakness in their GMAT, they had a high GPA. And my question is, what is your advice for someone who, say, has a very high GMAT score but a low GPA, and has the aspiration of going to like a Stanford or a Harvard? Or what advice would you give someone who has a low GPA but hasn't even started the whole application process but wants to go to a top tier school?
Well, I mean, a low GPA, I've often said to people, if you're going to have a weakness, the one that you'd want, if you have to have a weakness, the weakness you'd want to have is a low GPA. It's generally the easiest weakness to overcome if a school really likes everything else. It's been so long since I've been to school. Did we all start when we were 18, 19? Is that how old you're?
Back when you were so young.
Yeah, exactly. The mistakes of an 18, 19-year-old, if you spend a couple years in the workforce, it's really quite a long time ago for almost every single applicant to look back at first year, to look back at your freshman year. And so, it's something that you can overcome, but you need to show maturity and growth, and you can do that through your professional accomplishments, things like promotions and increased responsibility, and you can do that through a high GMAT score, and there's no kind of lucky number that immediately eradicates all past grades via your GMAT. The other thing you can do is, we talked about taking additional courses to help supplement your GMAT. Well, you can do that also to help create a symbolic break from the past in terms of your academic record. And so, if you can take classes from a new discipline, let's say, you were the English major and you had more fun than necessary at the undergrad level, go and take some classes that prove your management competencies, and also symbolically say, hey, this is a new day. I'm the straight A student at NYU summer school right now in three different classes, and hey, look at my GMAT. So, seize the day on that one.
How important are promotions in the corporate world? For a person like me, that I don't think I'm going to get promoted this year. I've only been in the workforce for 2 years. This year, where it's going to be kind of tough to get promoted. But, if I have military experience, what do you suggest? Because a friend told me, wait for next year until you get promoted.
I don't know your entire profile. I'm not a huge fan of waiting till next year to apply if you want to go now. I mean, if it doesn't make a difference to you, I suppose do it. But I wouldn't live my life you can always, there's theoretically your improvement is, it could be infinite. There always be a reason to defer. You could always make your application better. You could always take that class, increase that GMAT score, get another promotion, do more community service. Everyone's everyone's application is a piece of art that is constantly changing, and so I think we could talk offline about your particular circumstances. Your military experience is going to be deeply respected at virtually at every school. They're going to if you had some promotion during your military time, as I know, there's usually a pretty aggressive promotional schedule, and in a lot of the militaries around the world, that could be something you could point to. But promotion is not a necessity. There are lots of very flat organizations. Lots of people, I was a speechwriter. Where was I going to go from that? I wasn't going to become ambassador. That was it. It's a lot more in terms of what you do, and people can show. If you have a promotion that is in title only and there's no substance to it, or if you have a promotion that is that is not entitled, but you've been given more responsibility, you're better off being the latter candidate. So just talk about increases in responsibility, and your recommenders will talk about your growth in your position, and that should be fine. The title, not so relevant.
So my question is about the recommender. I'm wondering if the person should be in a very high position at my company, or it's okay if I ask my direct manager, who is not a managing director, but he knows me much better than my managing director does.
Right. Great question, a real classic. I think that question gets asked to us an awful lot, and it is definitely the sincerity and the intimacy of what the person is writing. That is what's important, less than your title. A recommendation written by someone who does not know you very well is going to have absolutely no punch. And a lot of people write these letters of recommendation, oh, Jeremy's a super guy, you're so lucky to have him, he's going to be a superstar in the future. And it doesn't mean anything at all. But the person who can pinpoint a specific experience and say, this is precisely where Jeremy shined, at our firm. These are the attributes that I've identified that allow him to stand out via this experience. It's something very, I'm giving you a very generic example, but that's it. It's way more important to have that kind of granular, narrow perspective on your accomplishments and be able to talk about you, as someone who is in an evaluative capacity. So definitely the quality of the relationship over the title, always. If those things are equal, sure, go with the title. We got the mic, so you got to wait for the mic to come around. But let's start there. We'll get you next.
Shall we?
No, go ahead.
Go ahead. I just had a follow-up question on the recommenders. Is it important to have one of your recommenders who represents your prior experience as well as your current employer, or can I have, say, my direct supervisor and my current employer and somebody else, a peer, who knows me very well in my current position?
Okay, the schools favor recommendations that are from the last 2 years or so. Of course, there are always exceptions to the rules. If you were at a job for 3 years and then you were at a job for 1 year, and someone from your position over 3 years supervised you closely, knows you well, has stayed in touch, of course, all these things require a lot of judgment. The key is that this person really knows you well and can comment on your growth and your capacity for growth in the future, your ability to perform. There's no sort of general rule for these things, but just as you pick your application, think to yourself, how well does this person know me? And then also think to yourself after that, how articulate can this person be? And it's not an adjective contest, but just, is this person capable of expressing himself in a way that's going to reveal me, the way I'd like to reveal? And you can do, if you're in a big company, the odds are you can do some some intelligence work on these recommenders. You can talk to someone else who's at business school who might have asked this person before you. You might find out, you know, that this person was incredibly helpful and was a very good recommender. You might find out this person missed deadlines, and that's the type of thing that's good to know in advance. So do a little bit of research and really, really think about this. And the other thing is, don't think about yourself as imposing on these recommenders. A lot of people are afraid to ask their bosses for recommendations. Some people are going to be difficult, and they're going to say no. So be it. But you know, it is their job as it's part of the responsibilities as a manager to be open to writing recommendations for high performers that are underneath, that are, you know, that serve beneath you. And you know, you just don't be afraid to ask and to go in and be very upfront. The thing that we always tell people not to do is to walk in and say, I've got one letter of recommendation for you to write because I don't want to ask you for two more because I feel like it's an imposition. And then like 3 weeks later, okay, I've got another one. Oh, I've got five more now. You know, it gets tired. You know, just be upfront from the beginning. Look, I need you to make a commitment. I'm willing to do whatever it takes to make it as easy as possible for you. Please, can you help me out? The last thing, while we're on this, I'm going to volunteer a question of my own unless someone wants to yell out, what if your recommenders want you to do the writing for you? And that's very frustrating, and it's very hard to be, to be self-aware about yourself, to write something that is dispassionate and at a distance from yourself that is also interesting, and it's hard to pick up on your own unique attributes that from someone else's perspective. That's why they ask for a second person's perspective. The entire thing is your perspective. You know, really, we advise you to try and stay away from that to the best of your abilities, and to consider looking for someone else if people won't help you. So starting this process now and talking to people about it now, you'll start to gauge where they are in that process. And, you know, the schools, we talked about this also at the AGAC conference, and, you know, a couple of them were generous enough to say that they don't really penalize people for writing their own letters because they recognize that that's thrust upon a lot of people whether they like it or not, but that they notice and it just sort of ends up being a zero. It's like, okay, whatever, you know, we just can't take this letter seriously, and we're not going to assume this person's a fraud, but we're just going to, you know, just accept that this doesn't mean much. So, you know, do your best to make sure you find someone who's committed to you. I think we should take maybe two more questions, and then we'll break up, and we're happy to stick around. Both Aaron and I, Chris, are happy to stick around afterwards. And again, you know, despite the fact that my back is covering the URL, you know, please take us up on the free consultation. So,
okay. So, how many recommendations do you really need?
How many recommendations you need? At some schools, you need two. At others, you need three. At some schools, they're willing to accept a third recommendation if it offers something new. So, if they say, you know, send us two recommendations, and you pick two professional examples, but there's one more. You know, there's one person from your community sphere that you think will be helpful to you, then. You know, then feel free to send in a third. Yeah, I would assume that that's a very different set of circumstances where the school would probably be very interested in your performance, and you know, the military is a pretty extreme, pretty extreme environment where I think it's a really good example of where you would want to look at someone from that area. You know, if you were, a bad example would be if you, 3 years ago you. You were working. You were still on campus at college, and you were working at the local restaurant or something like that. You know, it's not going to be terribly helpful to you, but something like that. That's quite an interesting window into who you are. Fantastic. Why don't we do the last question? I can feel like everyone's getting a little bit restless. We've been here for a while, and then we'll be around afterwards. So, Annette.
I was just wondering, in the beginning of the presentation, you gave the statistics about domestic people applying to, international students applying to domestic schools. I was just wondering what the statistics are for U.S. citizens applying to international schools, like in Europe, and if that has changed over the years.
According to the Wall Street Journal, this year there was a rise in the number of Americans applying to international schools, and then it actually went to an all-time high for sort of the top European programs. I don't know what the exact numbers were. If you email me, offline, I will send you. I'll send you a link to the article. Okay. Okay. Great. Thank you, everyone, for being so patient and for attending, and we'll speak to some of you soon.